Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Today we've got a little bit different angle. The book we're going to talk about is Swanson, and it's the life and times of a Victorian detective. So this is covering Donald Sutherland Swanson, and so it's more than just the Ripper. He's a detective in the Metropolitan Police. So we have a distinguished guest all the way from the UK on the line. His name's Adam Wood. Thank you for taking the time to talk.
Hello there, Al. Thank you for inviting me. Hi there, Mike.
Hello, Adam. How you doing?
Yep, good, thank you.
So now, I've noticed in this book here, this is just about the detective and his whole life, so we're covering a lot more than just the Ripper. What, first of all, got you into writing about this detective?
It was, to be honest, it was a very lucky circumstance in that my background the editor of Ripologist magazine, which I've been doing for more years than I care to remember. There's a series of articles on all sorts of angles, from suspects to the detectives and the victims. And I decided to write an article on what is known as a Swanson marginalia. It's something which I'm sure we'll talk about in detail later. But it's some personal pencil annotations made by Donald Swanson in a private book. And in that book, he names the suspect, which most people now tend to see Michael Disagree as the prime suspect for the Ripper. But I thought it was an interesting thing. So I started researching the history of this document and got quite far into the article just for publication in the magazine. And a mutual friend basically said to me, well, the Swanson family still have lots of the documents from Donald passed down the family. Would you like to meet them? And I said, well, of course, yes, please. So they didn't live too far from me, luckily, so I met the great-grandson of Donald, that's Neville Swanson. And we met up and he had a sample folder, really, of the sort of thing that you have, and it was personal correspondence and, copies of police documents and reports. And basically he said, would you like to borrow everything and see what we've got, because we don't really know what's there. So, it started out as an article on this Swanson marginalia, but when I saw all the archive material that they had, I just realised that although I knew a little bit about Swanson, he's not widely known in the Ripper world, what he did outside of that case. I just thought, well, there's so much material here. He had such a fantastic career that I'm going to research everything else. and see where it takes me. And it, 6 years later, the book is out. So that was it. So, you know, it's interesting because Jim Swanson, that's Neville's father and Donald's grandson, he knew all of this about his grandfather's career, and he was very keen that they'd have some recognition for the work that Donald had done, but it never had gone anywhere. And I think that having gone through the material, I obviously recognised that he was right. And obviously you can see in the book, the Ripper chapter as such is quite a small amount compared to the rest of the career, but it's an important part.
Well, I think also, Adam, what I loved about the book is that Swanson definitely has a pivotal role because he was the chief inspector during the time of the Ripper murders, and that anything that he knew so much. We don't have those original documents, and so any details he has. So what I love about it is to me, I'm amazed at how much research, original articles and pictures that you have in here. It's filled. It is content dense.
Thank you. Yeah.
And
I have to say, Al, that's probably part of the reason why it took so long to finish. But one of my pet hates is when you pick up a book and it's supposedly a biography of a policeman, and you're on the first page and there's a short paragraph about where he was born and early life, and then you're still on the first page and he's already joined the Metropolitan Police. That's not enough to me. I want to know the background. I want to know what made them become a policeman. Where the family grew up. What shaped that detective, for instance? So I was determined when I was writing this book on Swanson, I was going to definitely look into that. Now, Swanson grew up in Scotland in a really very, very small, remote town. And I thought, well, what would make someone growing up there? His father was a brewer. What would make someone growing up there decide to leave and go to London? You know, in those days, the 1860s, when he left, it was a massive undertaking to go down to London. There was no guarantee of work or anything at the time for him. So he must have been driven for some, you know, to go down and start a new career. And of course, when I started looking into that, I thought, well, where did he work initially as a city clerk for a year? I looked into the background of that employer and that series of offices. When he joined the police, why did he join the police? And there happened to be a recruitment drive because there was a Fenian bombing, terrorism threat at the time. So then, of course, I had to research that and write that up.
Well, that's what the and I was just gonna. I was gonna interrupt just a little bit. Right at that spot. There's two things. One is you wrote about he had a sister that was in London at the time, so that probably helped him come to London. Do you think?
I think absolutely. He definitely, you know, he had someone on the compass. It was because he had two sisters in London. They both married English firemen in London. Now, I've yet to discover how they met these two London firemen, but they met, and you know, one was a witness to the other's marriage and vice versa. So they lived in the West End of London, and I'm sure, you know, Donald worked as a teacher in Scotland for a while, but probably the prospects didn't appeal to him. Now, there's two things here. Firstly, did he decide to go to London for work, and his sister helped him out? Or as you say, there was one sister, Mary, who was pregnant, but her husband died 2 weeks before she was due to give birth to their third child. So the other thing is, did the family send Donald down to London to help out in that family crisis, which, you know, could well have been the case.
Right. Well, the other thing I loved about that particular part is it's not only a history of Swanson, but it's a history of the Met, the Metropolitan Police Department, and also the Detective Division as well, and all of the ups and downs.
Yes, yep. Again, that was something that I was, as well as Swanson's background, I was very keen to, as I picked out the strands of Swanson's career, and I saw that, you know, he was involved in the Detective Department. Two weeks after this so-called Trial of the Detectives fraud scandal rocked. Now, I thought, well, that's quite interesting because he was not involved in that. Obviously, he'd only just become a detective after being a uniformed policeman on the beat. But the thing is that was part of the Metropolitan Police at the time. So, again, I thought it was important to give that background. You know, what was a detective department like at the time he joined? And, of course, it very soon became the reorganised CID, which he became a leading officer of.
So the Fall of the Detectives you talk about is like 1877. Right. It's like the year after he joined the detective division. He didn't get sucked into it.
No, because there were very few members of detectives in the department at the time he joined. You know, half of that department got caught up in the corruption and they were on the take. And I think if Swanson would have been perhaps joined 6 months earlier, he may well have been susceptible to that. He was still a young man at the time, so newly married, so he may well have been sort of tempted. But thankfully for him, he was only 2 weeks in there when the whole thing blew up.
So, and then you write about that soon after that, or around that time, he solved the case or something, but it looks like they noticed that he was not part of the corruption part.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, the thing was, without going into too much detail, there was the detective department at Scotland Yard, and those were the detectives that were caught up in corruption. Each area outside of London, and Whitechapel, for instance, where the Ripper murders took place, was a H division. Swanson was a detective at A division, which was still close to Scotland Yard, but not in that office. So that, okay. As I say, he wasn't involved with that. And it was good for him, actually, because when all those officers were on trial and found guilty and went to prison, the new department, the CID, it was under sort of strict observation. You can imagine that everybody that worked in that department, you know, the new detective department, was under scrutiny. And they needed perhaps fresh detectives, fresh officers coming in that they could trust. Swanson was one of those. So it was quite good because he was able to get promotion quite quickly by proving himself to be, you know, incorruptible as such, or that, and obviously very astute as a detective.
Right. So the other thing was, to me, was interesting as well, is right at, during the Ripper murders, we had the commissioner, Charles Warren. He seemed to, he was not too keen on the detective division, but when he left during the Ripper murders and then James Monroe came in, he was more keen to that. So would that have helped him out?
I think that absolutely did. I mean, although interestingly, Warren was the commissioner who put Swanson in charge of the Ripper case, which we'll talk about in a moment, but Warren was brought in as commissioner in 1886 because the previous commissioner, Edmund Henderson, had been in the role for 18 years. He'd grown very lazy and slack, and the police had basically become completely disorganized. Warren was a really well-established and decorated soldier. He was brought in as a commissioner basically to put everything in good order and get the police back in a good position. So he would... But he never intended to sort of be a long-lasting commissioner. He wanted to get you're quite right, Al. His focus was on the uniformed branch rather than the detectives, who he left to his assistant commissioner, Munro.
One of the things, again, about Swanson, why I was really intrigued about your book with these details, is because of the background of the detective division during the Whitechapel murders. And you also make a comment about the relationship between Scotland Yard or the Metropolitan Police Department and the City of London Police Department.
That's right.
And what about that a little bit?
Well, it's interesting because in the early days of the Metropolitan Police, as I recount in the early chapters, there was talk very early on that the Met should absorb the City of London Police. And it was a very small force in the city, but there was massive uproar in government. They didn't want that to happen. Separate budget, separate home office departments, all this sort of thing. And that went all the way through. So there was some sort of friction between the two departments, the Metropolitan Police and the City of London Police. But I think there was a feeling, certainly through some of the city detectives at the time, that if we were investigating the Ripper murders, then we'd have solved it by now. You know, the Metropolitan Police aren't any good and all this sort of thing. There's a superiority thing. But of course, when Catherine Eddowes was killed in Mitre Square in the City of London territory, they were brought into it. So I think at that time, there's been some discussion with some Ripper authors that there was this still ongoing sort of animosity between the two. But I don't think that was the case. I think that they were professional policemen. They recognised they had to work together because they were under scrutiny of the newspapers and the public and the government to get the job done. And Swanson met every night. As you said earlier, he was in Scotland Yard looking through all the material. At the end of every evening of doing that, he had to go down to Whitechapel and met with the City of London counterpart there to sort of, you know, compare notes and then sort of go over the, prepare the next day's research, really, an investigation. So they did work well together. And it's funny because Swanson didn't write anything about the investigation at all, but some of his city counterparts did write that in their reports that it was Inspector Sagar met with Swanson every night. So as I say, so they worked well together. And then sometimes you hear in recent books that there was this, as I say, this animosity between the two forces, but I don't think that was the case in reality.
Especially after the Eddowes murder.
Well, exactly. I mean, beforehand, I suspect that before the City of London Police were drawn into the investigation, I think they probably thought, well, as I say, it was a little bit like Thomas Burns, the American policeman in New York, said that if it happened there, he could have solved it. I think the City of London Police were pretty much the same until they were involved and they realised they couldn't. So it was a different, entirely different thing then.
Well, what's also intriguing to me about Swanson, and soon I'd like to ask about the marginalia, but is that he must have been just this professional, didn't talk to people about it, and that's why we didn't hear so much about him, is because he was just a man that, you know, kept quiet.
I think that's exactly right. He did his job. He was a professional policeman. He did his job, went home at the end of the day, and didn't tell anyone, apparently. According to his grandson Jim Swanson, who knew him for 12 years before he passed away, he didn't tell even the family about the work he was doing. You know, obviously they were aware that he was working on the Ripper case at that time, but any other part of his career, he just didn't mention. He kept notes and kept in the early part of his career up to about 1882, he kept personal memorandum ledgers, and they are still in the archives. So I was very lucky to see his comments on some of those early cases. But interestingly, when he got to the 1880s and he was working on some bigger, more delicate cases, he didn't write anything. He stopped writing those ledgers. And I just wonder whether he sort of realised that the sort of thing he was working on was too delicate a nature to really put down in writing for anyone to see. And he certainly didn't speak to any newspapers after he retired. He retired as a superintendent of the CID, which is the top detective at Scotland Yard.
He couldn't, which means he must have been brilliant.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of two things there. He was a fantastic detective, but he was also very professional. So he didn't tell tales out of school. He didn't talk to the newspapers, which some other detectives did, and I'm sure they were overlooked for those promotions because of that. Because there was a Home Office directive that was breaking the rules. Really, a detective couldn't talk about their work, even in retirement.
Right. And then the thing that is, I think, to me, where it connects with Swanson is the marginalia. And you could talk more about that than me.
Well, I think you said a moment ago that Swanson was hardly known about at all until the marginalia was discovered. And I think that's absolutely right, because the newspapers at the time of the Ripper case were down in Whitechapel. They were talking to the detectives there, Frederick Aberline, Edmund Reed, these detectives, very, very capable detectives. They became not quite famous, and Aberline for a long time, and probably still today, if you ask a man on the street who was the detective hunting Jack the Ripper, they'll say Frederick Aberline, because that's the name that's in the newspapers every day. Swanson was operating out of an office in Scotland Yard, and he didn't talk to anybody at all. It was some news, you know, you don't get any interviews with him, you don't get any comments that Swanson's following a lead or anything like that. Occasionally, you may get something a few years later. For instance, the Mary Pearcy double murder, he investigated that, and the newspaper reported, Inspector Swanson, who had charge of the Ripper investigation, but that's it. There's nothing more than that. So, consequently, all the way through to the time when the National Archives files were open and people could read the Ripper reports and see that Swanson's name were at the bottom of most of those reports to the Home Office. It just wasn't known. It was just assumed that it was all Aberline. And then basically when his two daughters died in end of 1880, they were both in their 90s, and Jim Swanson, the grandson referred to, they had to go and empty the house out to take all the, basically do a house clearance while it was, so they could sell the property. When they got back to Jim's house, they went through everything they'd found, and in this linen chest, apparently it was a big chest which they used to keep in the hallway with all their sheets and stuff in the bottom of that was Donald Swanson's papers and personal address book and his copies of some of his colleagues' memoirs. One of these books was by his former boss, Sir Robert Anderson, who was the assistant commissioner. That's called The Lighter Side of My Official Life, and that's the book where Anderson says that the suspect was a Polish Jew. He was caged in an asylum, it was known that he was a ripper, but we couldn't prove it. So that book was among perhaps about six or seven other books in Swanson's library. When Jim Swanson flicked through the book, he found these pencil notes, which is the Swanson marginalia, and he describes, or he basically expands on what Anderson has written about the Polish Jew suspect, giving more information as to what happened to him. And then on the end paper, right at the end of the book, he writes a continuation, and he gives the full breakdown as to, you know, the suspect was identified, he was taken and watched night and day by the city CID. He was taken to Whitechapel Workhouse, and then he was taken infirmary. Then he was taken to Colney Hatch, where he died. And then he writes a line: Kosminski was the suspect. So that is where the whole thing about Kosminski being the prime suspect comes from, basically just from those pencil marginalias and his private copy.
And he was quite literate as well. So to me, how he spelled it is likely what the name was. So
there's a question about that, isn't there? Because it's K-O-S with an I on the end, and several times it's written K-O-Z, sometimes with a Y on the end. But I think Swanson or any detective who's working on the case would have been careful how they spelt a name, because, you know, if they had an official file there, newspapers obviously not quite so careful. They would perhaps taking notes down as people were talking to them, and it's a little bit like the census returns where you misspell something because you don't check the spelling. But I think you're right. I think Swanson would have been more careful with the spelling and the phrasing of what he was writing.
Right.
Well, how well were the police trained back then? Like, what was their technique in doing these crimes?
Do you mean in terms of the uniformed or the detectives?
Either. I mean, especially, like, what would happen in an actual crime? And how well was Swanson trained as a detective?
Well, in the first instance, when a candidate applied to join the Met, they went through a physical examination, and then they had to do a writing and arithmetic examination. This is all on one day, just to sort of prove that they had the basics in order to be able to join. Then when they were accepted, they'd go and do 3 months drill training, which again harks back to the military side of things, and make sure that they could walk upright and they could do the recommended so many miles in a day and that sort of thing. So they became almost like an army. That's the uniformed side of it. They'd go and get, once those 3 weeks are up, they'd go and get their uniform, then they'd be assigned to a division, and then they'd have to sort of take part in beat walking. Swanson did his fair share of that, and his initial beat was around Westminster, which is like Trafalgar Square and Downing Street, all that sort of area. But when he whether that was a reason for joining the detective department is because he was sort of fed up with wearing a uniform, and in those days you had to wear a uniform even on your days off, so there was no opportunity for 9-to-5 job and that sort of thing. It was hard work, and I suspect that the detective department probably was getting a little bit busier. It wasn't formed until 1842, which was 13 years after the main uniform branch, and so by the time of the corruption case, it had only been in existence sort of 25 years. And I think it was sort of gaining a little bit of glamour, that sort of thing. They worked on some of the sort of famous cases, and there's one which, just after Swanson joined, was the theft of the Gainsborough painting, Duchess of Devonshire. That was a sort of big thing, and it wasn't recovered for 25 years, and Swanson was involved in that later on in his career. Talk about it later. But in terms of detection, they didn't really have any great training in those early days. They'd have to go through a test and sort of do, I think, sort of rudimentary things, you know, reading and writing, and then probably there was like a logic test. But really, it was down to aptitude, I think. One of the few officers who was involved in the detective department in those corruption days was Frederick Dolly Williamson, and he was a very, very famous detective who had a great career. He was one of the few who sort of survived the finger of suspicion, if you like. And he I think sort of took Swanson under his wing when he joined and became his mentor in a way. Because you see in some of those cases, such as the civil uprisings in 1887 and 1886, and the Fenian, again, the second dynamite campaign in the mid-1880s, it's Swanson who's going around with Williamson looking at these cases. So I suspect that in Swanson's case, he learned a lot from Dolly Williamson, and that was mostly through experience rather than sort of any examinations or anything like that. Or they didn't have classrooms as such to do any sort of tutoring for detection. Most of it was, as I say, ability, raw ability, and learning from experience from older officers.
So probably Chief Inspector Littlechild was his contemporary at the time?
He was. And interestingly, about Littlechild, when I was doing some research into Swanson's early days in the Met, it turns out I think Littlechild joined the police, I think, within the same 3-month period as Swanson did. They both went to A Division, as I say, around Westminster. So they I'm sure they knew each other, Littlechild and Swanson, probably as far back as the late 1860s.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I just wonder, so how did they arrive at suspects back then? Like, what was it? They didn't have fingerprints. They didn't have hair analysis or DNA and any of that stuff. So what would lead him and other detectives to decide who their suspect was for, let's say, Jack the Ripper or the railway murders or any of that stuff?
Well, in a case such as the Lefroy Mapleton railway murder that you mentioned, that was quite obvious because, you know, you've got a guy here who's there's a body found on a railway line, and there's also a guy who's found coming out the carriage on his own covered in blood. That was quite obvious,
yeah,
really.
Right.
But in Swanson's case, it was interesting because although Lefroy had been sort of escorted.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Back to his lodgings by a policeman. he said, well, would you mind, it's unbelievable really, but he said to the officer, would you mind waiting outside for me? I'll be down in a minute. Went in the front door and slipped out the back door and went on the run for 11 days. And Swanson basically was given the job from Scotland Yard to go out and hunt him down and had a bit of a tip off. And this is one way that a detective would find a criminal, will be through an informant. And this is what happened in the Lefroy case. You know, he went and they sort of did some surveillance, made sure he was there and arrested him. But sometimes it would be informants. Sometimes it would be, you know, little things like sort of observations. But, you know, really, in terms of sort of identifying a suspect, in terms of the Ripper case, you know, you were relying on, you do your house-to-house questioning in, you know, if there's a body been found in Hanbury Street in Annie Chapman's case, they'd go around all the neighbours, has anyone seen anything in the last sort of 12 hours or whatever, and then piece together a report as to what the witnesses had seen and that sort of thing. And then you could identify who was a person of interest. But in the Ripper case, of course, you had so many people keen to be the ones to identify the killer. You had all the hoax letters. You know, they I don't think any of them were really from the Ripper, but they still had to be investigated and written off as sort of dead ends as such. But sometimes you may find someone that was a person of interest, and sure, Mike can explain how the suspect Tumblety came to prominence at the time. You know, obviously, as far as Ripper researchers are aware, it only came much later through a letter well after the thing by Littlechild, who mentioned Tumblety. Yeah. So, but at the time, he must have come to the he must have come to the police's attention in some way.
Right, right. And then the other person, Sir Melville McNaughton, the memorandum, you've done some research with that. How was the relationship between Swanson and McNaughton?
It's again, that's very difficult to say, because there's nothing that I found, apart from one little thing, which I'll mention in a moment, that sort of gives them any indication they're on good terms. With Swanson and Robert Anderson, he's boss, you know, there's evidence that they sent each other Christmas cards, and they sent, you know, Anderson would occasionally send a copy of his book to Swanson. So they did have a relationship outside of the office as such, and after they both retired. But in McNaughton's case, there's certainly nothing in the Swanson family archive that shows any correspondence. Donald Swanson's personal address book, which I'm lucky to own, it's got Anderson's address in there and it's got Abilene's address in there, but there's nothing from McNaughton. So I don't think that they were particularly close. I'm sure they had a good working relationship. And I think, as I say in the book, and as McNaughton has written in his memoirs, when he was talking about the Lefroy case, when he joined the police in 1889, he discovered that one of his officers at CID was the man who arrested Lefroy. And of course, he's talking about Swanson. So he went to Swanson and he learned all the facts about that case. So I suspect that's exactly what he did with the Ripper investigation. You know, he knew Swanson was in charge of that case. So he just went to his office and went through all the files and the notes and everything. But right, one interesting thing, which I think is a bit of an insight in Anderson's book, where the Swanson marginalia appears, there's another part earlier on, and he just talks, Anderson just writes about one of the, I can't remember the exact wording, but he says one of the contemporaries had a little bit of problem with the Commissioner of Home Office, and he was censured. And he doesn't name who he is, but in the margin, Swanson writes in pencil, Chief Constable McNaughton. So he wasn't at all bothered with naming the officer who got himself into trouble. So I think if he was, you know, if they were good friends, he may have refrained from doing that. But
oh, I get you, right? Yeah. It looks like now that Mapleton case, the railroad murderer, that was towards the end of Swanson's career. Is that correct?
That was actually in 1881. That was
okay.
quite early in his, 5 years after he became a detective. And it was interesting because that probably was the case that really accelerated his career, because before then, while he was, I'm not saying just another inspector, certainly when he arrested Lefroy, because Lefroy was on the run for 11 days. And it's interesting because that case is the first time that a likeness of a wanted man was printed in a national newspaper. So that's quite a well-known case. And of course, with Swanson being the detective who arrested him and took him into the police station, his name was then in all the national newspapers. So the next case that Swanson goes on to, which is a body snatching case up in Scotland, and I think literally a week after Lefroy was executed, Swanson's now working on this body snatching case. When he arrives in Aberdeen, where the thing took place, the local newspaper reports that the locals looked on, as he stepped off the train, the locals looked on Inspector Swanson with awe as the capture of Lefroy. They'd read all about his exploits in capturing Lefroy, and of course, the next thing, he's suddenly in their town, and he's a bit of a celebrity. And I think it went from there. Yet you see Swanson's name much more in the newspapers then, because he's well known.
Right. Something interesting is that I was intrigued about is my very first article that you had published for me in the Ripperologist magazine, and I think it was 2010. It was on.
Was it really?
It was on the Philosopher's Stone, and then you write some stuff about Swanson with the Philosopher's Stone.
That's right. Yes, Edward Pinter, his name was.
Okay.
That's a great. I think that's a great case, because that was a case where an instance where they caught him out through surreptitious surveillance, if you like. Basically, the chap called his name was Edward Pinter, but he called himself the Modern Alchemist. Bit grand. He'd go round to West End posh jewellers, saying that if they gave him a certain amount of gold by using alchemy and the philosopher's stone and all this sort of secret recipe, if you like, he could turn that thousand pounds worth of gold into 10,000 pounds, and then if you gave him 10,000, he turned it into 1,000,000 pounds of gold. And some people were sucked into it. It's obviously a scam. At one point he went to this jeweller, quite a well-known jeweller who supplied diamonds and things to countesses and earls and sort of thing. So his name was Edward Streeter. And when Pinter went in to see him, obviously he knew that it was obviously a complete scam. He went straight to Scotland Yard, and Swanson went with a young sergeant called Frank Frost, who became a very famous detective later on. They went along to this sort of arranged meeting as a setup with Streeter and Pinter, I could just visualise it, because Swanson and Frost are hiding in a cupboard, watching what's going on. You could just visualise. You know, it's not a case of we have reason to believe. It was let's catch him red-handed.
I remember Frost. He was known. He could bend a penny with his fingers. He was a powerful guy. Just think.
He certainly wasn't someone you'd want to argue with. I don't think so. I think. And what they did in this case is that the Modern Alchemist basically said, "Well, here's all the ingredients. You know, you give me the gold, and I'll put the chemicals in. But the smell and the smoke is so intense, we need to leave the room while the magic is working." So he's done this. This massive black vapour has appeared. They've all gone out. And of course, he's obviously said, "Well, I'll go in and check how things are going." And while he's gone in, he's just sort of been removing items of gold from the pan.
Wow.
And I think eventually, you know, he was so brazen, though. It did make me smile, because when he was arrested by Swanson and Frost and taken to Bow Street Magistrates Court, he basically said to the judge, "Well, if you let me set up here, I'll prove that I can do it." And so, well, that's pretty brazen. I think the judge said something along the lines of it was bad enough smell in the courtroom as it was. He didn't need any more adding to it.
Yeah. Do you remember what year that was?
From top of my head, I think 1895-96.
Okay, okay. So that was after the White
House. That was after that, yeah, yeah. And okay. And again, it's interesting because it goes back to what we were saying earlier about how did the detective become a detective, because Swanson, Frost was the sergeant at the time, but he worked quite a lot with Swanson, and certainly later in Swanson's career, you see that he becomes a mentor to Frost in the same way that Williamson was to Swanson. And obviously, eventually, when Swanson retires, I think Frost becomes a superintendent at CID in his place. So it's that working relationship there.
What was the biggest surprise you got when you were researching Swanson?
That is a good question. I think probably overall, I was probably mostly surprised with how much material still existed from the family, because, you know, you couldn't, I don't think that will ever happen again on my next book. I don't think I'll ever find anything like that. But in terms of the biggest single surprise, that I think it was satisfying, but it was a bit of an eye opener. When I was researching the Gainsborough painting, Duchess of Devonshire, it was basically been taken and stored in America for the 25 years it had gone missing. Basically, the Pinkerton agency got involved with with the return, but they were liaising with Swanson, who by this time was a superintendent, obviously in charge at the CID. And I knew that was the case. And when the Pinkertons confirmed that they had the genuine painting and that, you know, this was the amount of money that they wanted and everything like this, they were telegram going back and forth to Scotland Yard and the Pinkerton office. Now I've researched it from this side, so from the Scotland Yard side, but I thought, well, for completeness, I ought to see if I can get hold of the Pinkerton file. And luckily, it's not that long. Well, at the time I wrote it, it wasn't that long, being basically made available at the Library of Congress. So I contacted them through the website and said, well, I'm interested in this one particular file. Here's the reference. How can I go about getting a copy? And I did, you know, I had no plans to go over. So I was thought, well, if they won't supply a copy, I'll have to see if I know anyone in the area who are happy to go along. But they said, well, no, we can digitise it and send you a PDF for this fee. So great. So I paid the fee. About 2 weeks later, I got a PDF, opened up, had the cover file, opened up the next page. The first thing I saw was a telegram from Swanson to the Pinkertons. Basically saying, well, all the terms are agreed and the owner of the painting is going to be over at this time and everything. It was just, in terms of information, it wasn't earth shattering, but it was just fantastic to, you know, get that thing from America, from the Pinkertons. And then the first thing you see is the guy who I'm writing the book about.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, that was very good.
Hmm. So what kind of cases did he typically do back then? Like, what was going on in London when he was a cop?
Well, that again is another interesting thing, because when you look at the whole of the book, 35-year career from 1868 to 1903, when he retired, as well as the development of the Met and the detection methods that they, you know, you can see the evolution of that. There's a lots of evolution of the types of crimes that are being committed. And it would be sort of simple, in the early days, it would be simple forgeries, palming false coins in shops, you know, that sort of thing that people would be doing. And occasionally there'd be, you know, be sort of murders, or there'd be kidnappings and this sort of thing. Those are few and far between. It was probably quite mundane in those early days. But certainly while he was on the beat, it would be a case of, preventing premises being robbed and all those very, very boring things that the uniformed officers have to do. But as a detective, as I said, you know, he could be working on the Lefroy case or a body snatching case, but then the next week he may be given the file, which means he has to go and look at someone who's been defrauding old ladies out of their life savings. It's just the way it was for a detective, and as I'm sure it is now. But when he became a detective, a superintendent rather, he did very little on the street or visiting premises. It was completely directing his chief inspectors under him to sort of go and undertake investigations and that sort of thing. So I guess it's probably what he was being groomed to do all the way along. working underneath Williamson, taking charge of the Ripper case, taking charge of the Dynamite thing. It was probably being groomed to be that superintendent supervisory role all along, really.
What do you hope people get after they read the book and they walk away? What do you want them to take with them?
I think it's more than anything, I want them to realise that the Whitechapel murders didn't happen in a vacuum, you know, and I think there's too much tunnel vision. You know, people are blinkered saying, well, in 1887, right, this happened, and in 1889, that happened, and then the file closed. You know, these people didn't just appear out of nowhere. They didn't magically, there wasn't a Chief Inspector Swanson who magically appeared and he never had a life before. So what I want is, if nothing else, is, you know, obviously I want people to be entertained and learn something about not only Swanson, but the Met Police, but I also want them to think, well, you know, there's, everything's in a context, in a context, really. And that I think does help give information about any particular case, the investigation of the Ripper murders or suspects. Why do these things come to pass? Because, as I say, they don't happen on their own. There's a cause and effect of everything, and that's really what I want people to take away.
Now, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, now you're the editor of the Ripperologist magazine.
That's right.
And so tell the listeners, what is the Ripperologist magazine and how they can maybe pick one up?
Well, it's the good news is that it's completely free. That's one of the, the Ripperologist magazine has been going since 1994. I've been on the editorial team since 1997, which I can't believe, really. But in those early days, it was a printed circulation magazine. You subscribe so much a year, and you'd get six issues, and it'd be posted out to you. Of course, after a while, it just became so expensive to mail out all these printed copies that we sort of took a decision. And each issue was getting larger and larger, up to 100 pages. We just decided as a team that we just couldn't, on the current subscription rate, we couldn't sustain printing and mailing out this number of heavy magazines. So we were faced with a choice of increasing the subscription cost or turning it to an electronic magazine. This is at the time where people started to do that. So we canvassed the subscribers and said, well, do you want to, would you still subscribe if it was an e-zine or not? And people in the main were sort of very supportive. So we went that way. And that was great because it took away any constrictions about page count or anything like that. But what we do, now, we decided to completely take away the subscription costs, and we just mail it out to anyone who sends their email address to subscribe. So we've ended up with something like about 2,500 readers of each issue now. Supposed to be every 2 months, but sometimes real life gets in the way.
You know what? One of the things I like about this is I have to apologize, Adam. My next article I'm going to propose is over 10,000 words already. So
no, that's fine.
Well, your fellow editor, Jonathan Mankes, teases me about that.
Well, that's the next issue sorted out then. But basically, you know, obviously the mag goes on and people are still interested in the case. But and generally it sort of follows a format. There's three or four new researched articles about any aspect, really. We'll take anything which is well researched, hopefully referenced, so it sort of shows that, you know, where the work's come from. And then we occasionally do it from the archives, because we've been going so long, there's always fantastic work which people who have recently subscribed or more recently don't always know that we've done. You know, we've carried a work from the past. So occasionally we'll republish something which is relevant to current thinking. And then we have some things from Howard Brown, who's the proprietor of JTRForums.com. He runs a column. Then we do the latest book reviews in fiction and non-fiction. So it's quite a good rounding magazine. And I think what is interesting when you look back at back issues and today's work, it really is, I think, a reflection on how research and different thinking on the Ripper cases has come along, really. Because in the early days, there was loads of articles on Joe Barnett as a suspect. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. And obviously now it's more along the lines of Tumblety and Kuzminski, which is more the current sort of thinking. So it's a good reflection on that. But what I like is, certainly with social media you find that there's people, we think, well, we've got all the subscribers we're ever going to get. How many people want to get a Jack the Ripper magazine in their inbox? But then, you know, every issue I put a post up on Facebook saying, well, this, the magazine's coming out next week. If you don't subscribe, go to ripologist.co.uk and there's a form on there. And in every issue, there's another 40, 50 people sign up, you know, haven't heard of it before. So that's great news.
Now I'm seeing that you also do what you're editor of the Police History Society Journal. Now,
yes.
What is that?
Well, again, that's one of those sort of lucky quirks of fate. In the there's a international group called the Police History Society, and they've been going for many, many years, longer than the magazine, Ripologist magazine, I think. But because of my work on Ripologist as the editor, and I also do the artwork, my background is a graphic designer and book publisher. One of the chaps who subscribes, I've known for 20 years, he's also the treasurer of the Police History Society. He's a retired serving policeman. And he basically approached me, the previous editor has had to step down from that journal, and said, well, you know, with my knowledge or an interest in police history, specifically Victorian stuff, would I be interested in taking on that role? Now that's only like a once a year sort of full printed 80 to 100 page thing. So it's not that involved as far as I'm concerned compared to Ripologist or book writing, but it's fascinating because where I'd gone into it looking at, initially, you know, can almost track my interest from the Ripper investigation into Victorian policing, then into Edwardian policing. That magazine, that journal completely opens my eyes because they've got things like policing in Hong Kong in the 1930s. You know, some things you wouldn't even consider, but it's part of police history. And I think history is so important over and above crime in itself. But you can learn from that and the different policing methods. So that is something which, you know, again, it's a labour of love, and I sort of almost like volunteer to do it. But it's like an education for me.
With the
Police History Society thing, yeah.
I was saying is also publisher for Mango Books.
Yeah.
And and when you look through all the books there, it's not just Ripper books. It's true crime. It's a lot of the things that you're talking about.
I think that's it. But Mango Books only came around because when I started writing Swanson and I knew it was going to be a big book, I thought, well, if I take this to another publisher, they're going to say, you need to lose half of it. And I didn't want to do that. So I thought, I'll self-publish it. But because of my background in graphic design and, you know, printing contacts and that sort of thing, I thought, well, I'll do it for myself. If nothing else, I'll just self-publish it. But my design company is called Mango. So I just thought, well, I'll do Mango Books. But then Neil Bell, who's as you know, is a great researcher on police history, especially in the Ripper case, he said, well, I didn't know you were going to go into publishing. I've got an idea for a book. Would you do that? And I thought, well, while I'm still writing Swanson, I'll do that and have a practice. So we did that. That went well. And then someone else came up and said, well, I didn't know you were a publisher. I've got a book on the craze. Will you do that?
And even fall back too.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's gone from there. I think I've published close on 30 books now. And it got to a point where I just didn't have any time to write Swanson. And last year I just thought, well, I just got to not take any more submissions for Mango Books till I finish my own thing, and go there. But yeah, Paul Begg was very, very lucky and honoured with that, really, because he's very famous book, The Jack the Ripper A to Z. It's I think in hard format. It came out in 2010, and it was, as a nature of that book, it's sort of out of date almost straight away. I know they did an updated Kindle one, but Paul approached me saying, well, we're looking to get team back to completely revise this in a different format, and would you be interested in publishing it? Well, if there's one book I sort of decided I'm going to close Mango Books, that'd probably be it, really. But
right.
I don't intend to do that, but that's a great honour. That's a great honour to be, you know, approached with a book like that where it could go to any mainstream publisher, and they'd be delighted to take it on, I think. So thank you to Paul if you're listening.
Yeah.
So now, do you have a website as well that people can go and find you and find out more about what you do?
Well, the best place to go to is mangobooks.co.uk. That talks about the book publishing side of things. I'm in the process of setting up, now Swanson's out, and I'm working on other projects, so I've been booked to give talks and interviews elsewhere. I'm in the process of setting up a website to promote myself, if you like. But there is a Facebook page, Adam Wood Author, which is in early stages, if people want to go there. If you want to find out about Ripologist magazine, then go to ripologist.co.uk. If you just want to find out about Swanson, you can go to donaldswanson.co.uk, and there's information there and a link to a Facebook page where I post daily updates, or every other day I post a short extract from the book, which give a bit of flavour of what's going on in there.
Fantastic. So now we'll have your book up on our website. We'll have your
information
as well, so people can go to it if they're listening. Again, it's been really interesting, and we appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much.
So our guest
absolutely.
Our guest has been Adam Wood, and we're talking about the book Swanson. It's the life and times of a Victorian detective. Again, thank you.
Thanks very much, Al. Thank you, Mike.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.